Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Sister Janet Ferns. Today's program looks at very different ways of searching for justice and peace. In the face of continued injustice, starvation, police brutality and the international condemnation of a corrupt regime, Archbishop Pius Ngube of Bulawayo describes the difficulties that people encounter in Zimbabwe as they try to feed and care for themselves and their families. The church in Britain is also fighting for justice. Archbishop Vincent Nichols of Birmingham speaks of the importance of continuing the struggle to retain Catholic schools. St. Francis of Assisi saw, even in injustice, a possibility of finding true joy, the joy of the cross. Franciscan friars, Fathers Murray Bodo and Bill Short, talk about perfect joy, a joy found in the midst of suffering. First, however, Lydia O'Kane tells us about today's general audience.
Thousands of pilgrims joined Pope Benedict XVI in a cold and blustery St. Peter's Square for his weekly general audience. The Holy Father continued his reflections on the fathers of the early church, focusing this week on St. Justin.
Dear brothers and sisters, continuing our catechesis on the fathers of the early church, we consider today St. Justin, philosopher and martyr. St. Justin was born in Samaria, Palestine, around the year 100. During his youth, he ardently sought the truth. After meeting with an old man who directed him to prayer and the study of the prophets, the saint converted to Christianity.
Pope Benedict went on to talk about the writings of this early saint, some of which are still in existence.
Of his written works, only his two apologies and his dialogue with Trifo remain. These emphasize God's project of creation and salvation, which find fulfillment in Jesus Christ, who is the Logos, or Word of God. Before the birth of Christ, the Logos allowed men and women to come to know part of the truth about God and man.
At the conclusion of the audience, the Holy Father imparted his apostolic blessing upon the crowd.
May this Lenten season purify our hearts and fill you with joy, and may God bless you all.
I'm Lydia O'Kane.
Cry, my beloved country. Archbishop Pius Ngube now tells us of his people of Zimbabwe, who are hungry and becoming even hungrier as they starve for a justice which is denied them.
They would only be given water, no food. And I saw their backs. They had been badly beaten with rubber truncheons.
In case you didn't know, in parts of southern Africa, the word panel beating means that a person has been arrested and questioned by the police. Sadly, the investigation is often carried out with the help of fists, feet and truncheons, hence the term panel beating. If someone is accused of a crime by a member of the public, then serious thought is essential. Is there a nearby police station where panel beating does not take place? Is the crime that has been committed sufficiently serious to require arrest, even if the suspect will be beaten in the process? If there has to be serious consideration of the consequences if a crime has been committed, then what can be said when the only crime is that of a starving individual trying to feed a family in spite of a capricious and unjust legislation? Archbishop Pius Ngube, Archbishop of Bulawayo in Zimbabwe, describes what happens to small-scale miners.
Overnight, these people are just cracked down upon. The whole lot of police camps up and down those areas where there are mines. These people were taken, beaten, brought to the camp. I was talking to some of them. They would stay for a whole week without food. And they were forced, they were then taken by the police and told with their bare hands to go and cover the pits where they had been doing gold panning.
Zimbabwe is a beautiful country, rich in mineral wealth. Coal, gold and gemstones have, for many years, been an important part of the economy. The massive colliery at Hwange, for instance, boasts one of Africa's most valuable sources of brown coal. With the collapse of the tourist industry, many Zimbabweans turned their hands to small-scale mining.
These people, first of all, since there are no jobs in Zimbabwe, with very high inflation, with starvation, with lack of food, transport becomes impossible. It's so expensive to travel now in Zimbabwe that many people can't travel. Schools, many just don't have decent teachers. So in that kind of situation, some of these people were surviving on doing small-scale mining. At a certain point, Mugabe's government then gave licenses to small-scale miners to do some limited mining. And they were doing gold panning and so on. But just about 2 months ago, the government just passed a new law. We now stop small-scale mining without any warning to the people. They went around arresting these people. I saw some of these people had been badly beaten by the police, arresting 20,000 of these small-scale miners. And many of these people, since there are no jobs in Zimbabwe, they were living on this. You see, they would do some gold panning. They would then take their products to a certain place and they get it weighed and they get money. And this way they're paying school fees for their children, taking care of the work clinic. They could assist food security for their wives and children and so on.
Hunger is a real possibility. And yet, were they given the opportunity, there are alternatives. People just need to be given the chance to use their natural creative talents and their ability to trade.
But overnight they crack down on them, and so they have no livelihood. These people are going to starve to death. Some of them were weeping and saying, we're going to starve to death with our children. We have nowhere else to run. We have this government that just doesn't care about the people.
And the people I saw myself are so gifted with the traditional crafts that they were able to create and sell to the tourists. But if the tourism industry is going down, that's another loss of livelihood, isn't it?
Yes, yes. The people in Zimbabwe are very gifted, especially if you go like to Harare. You go to some of these, you look at the sculpture, they're even in stone.
Oh, they are beautiful.
It's out of this world. And then how they make, they will weld and they create sculptures of guinea fowls and through welding iron pieces of animals. It's out of this world. People are very, very creative in Zimbabwe. Actually, if things got back to normal in Zimbabwe, Zimbabwe would have such a booming, would boom. I mean, it would be quite amazing. It would, the skill, the talent and also hard workmanship. People are so hard working. For instance, I remember before they cracked down, ladies would come from Harare and go to South Africa, and they would go to Botswana. And sometimes they would take some of these African vegetables, go and sell them in Botswana, get money there and bring goods. And Zimbabweans are very, very gifted. It's just that they have a very bad government that doesn't care for its people. If things got back to normal in Zimbabwe, I think, a certain African priest, and he's a Monsignor, he's a very, very intelligent man. He's 50 years a priest, he's 8 years old. You are saying, the day Zimbabwe gets back on track, it's going to outdo, because the people are so creative and hardworking, it's going to outdo all its neighbors, including South Africa, Botswana, Swaziland, Mozambique. It's just going to outdo them. Mm-hmm. But the problem is inflation. Inflation just kills everything in Zimbabwe. People People find themselves unable to do anything, except those are outside the country channeling their monies through to build new homes and so forth. These small businesses, they collapse. Some of the bigger businesses relocate to Botswana and South Africa because they just can't make it anymore.
They need health care.
We have a beautiful hospital run by Franciscan missionaries of Divine Motherhood. At one time it was said to be one of the best hospitals in Southern Africa, Mater Dei. Mater Dei, it's a miracle that Mater Dei just keeps going on and on and on, despite the 2,000% inflation. Mater Dei suffers because, more and more we just don't have, specialists and doctors are leaving. So Mater Dei would need, for instance, we'd need something like 1,000 surgeons. But then we have only 3 surgeons, so that keeps the bed occupancy low. And to keep the hospital running, you need a certain percentage of bed occupancy. But if your bed occupancy comes down to 40% or even goes lower than that, you might find yourself closing down the hospital. But it's impossible. Nurses are leaving, medicines are not available, workers are demanding more pay, and sometimes I went to Mater Dei to plead with them not to strike. The administrator often suffers a lot of depression because of a whole lot of disorders, very high food expenses, equipment difficult to replace. Staff members have a very low morale. So in that very situation, you find that things just don't work, but the government is doing nothing at all.
Every child has a right to education. Archbishop Vincent Nichols speaks of children united by their faith rather than by their social status in the second of 2 programmes about Catholic education in Britain. What happens to children who are not Catholics but who attend Catholic schools? Do they have to attend classes in religious education, or is some provision made for them? Archbishop Vincent Nichols of Birmingham is also the spokesman for the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. He comments,
"At the moment, Catholic schools present in the RE lessons and in the worship, so the liturgies of the school, they present and live by Catholic teaching. And that is always, and always will be, at the heart of a Catholic school. What is very clear to parents as they bring their children to our schools is that that's what will be done, and that's what is expected, that that's the ethos, the culture, the environment in which all aspects of learning take place. There is a right in law for people, for parents to withdraw their pupils from religious education, collective worship. Very few exercise it, because I think once they make the choice of wanting a Catholic school, they accept that it is an integrated whole. And in any case, even if they did do that, they couldn't withdraw from the ethos of the school. So it's not as if a Catholic school is a secular school with a particular religion bolted on at the side. It's a vision of the person, a vision of the process of education, a vision of a community, all centred on Christ. And that's inescapable in a Catholic school.
And it's been in the news several times recently about schools where Muslim girls have not been able to wear the hijab. Does that sort of question ever arise within the Catholic school, or is it that because they're coming into a Catholic ethos, they just fit in with the uniform policy of the rest of the school?
In my experience, Muslim girls and the occasional Muslim teacher who is in a Catholic school are quite free to wear a headscarf, but not the veil that covers their face, because I think that clearly impedes the normal processes of teaching and learning.
But does this impede multiculturalism? What is the place of religion in public life?
It's an interesting indication that the mood in England has moved from what is called a kind of multiculturalism to something that is much more directed towards helping people to live together rather than separately. So in a way, there was a strand of multiculturalism which was kind of let people do their own thing. It didn't particularly promote understanding of that, and it certainly did not promote an appreciation of what the roots in faith of a people's culture might be. And in my view, and a view I've kept held for a number of years, it was bound to fail because it treated a person's culture as a kind of rather quaint set of practices or habits. And it wasn't particularly respectful in the positive sense. It was tolerant, but it was never going to bear any fruit because it had no roots. So now we're involved in England in, I think, a much more delicate and far more important debate about what is the place of religious faith in public life and in politics. And I think a slow recognition that without the recognition of a person's religious faith, you will never get the best citizenship. Though there is a hard core of those who ideologically want to see religious belief entirely out of the public arena. And that's a very powerful and important debate that is taking place now.
Yes, one of the cardinals said when the Pope's Lenten message was presented that it seems that society is actually at a turning point at this present time.
Well, I would think that is probably true in England. And I think it's attached itself to a few key issues, such as those issues that you've mentioned with regard to the Muslim practices, both the pattern of attire and the educational question. I think that's true, and I think both British government and churches and other voluntary bodies should be very proud of the educational system that we've got and the serious and very fruitful partnerships that are included in it. I don't think there's a better one anywhere in the world that I'm aware of, and I think many politicians know this. And they appreciate it, and I don't think they want to see it in any way undermined, not the broad middle ground of politics.
In Britain, both faith and non-faith schools receive government funding. This enables Catholic schools to cater for all social classes within the one school, the children united by their faith rather than by their position within society at large. As Archbishop Nichols points out, society is at a turning point, and religion is being seen as part of the solution, not as the problem to be ignored or eliminated.
And I believe there is a growing appreciation, stimulated by those things, that faith is a powerful motivator for people to contribute to the common good. And it's a powerful motivator for people to have a passionate concern about justice and a passionate concern about those who are most in need. I mean, another area in which I think is going to be very important in British politics, and we saw it a year ago with Cardinal Murphy O'Connor and in Westminster Diocese with a big mass and a rally that he held for undocumented migrant workers. And that will be repeated this May. And I think there's a great deal of encouragement to the churches to speak up, to act and to speak up in an area of real need and real poverty, where for all sorts of reasons governments and local authority have excluded themselves from action. And I think quietly there's an appreciation that we need each other, So I don't think by any means, across the generality of British politics, that what we face is an outright facing up one against the other. No, I think there's a far longer tradition of partnership which will continue, but it's being clarified. And I think there is a growing awareness that if we're to hold together as a society, we need all the best that faith can bring. Slowly, I would like to think, when we look at British society and its search to hold together, faith is being seen as part of the solution and not cast, as it has been for the past 7 or 8 years or less, as part of the problem.
Perfect joy is not what we might expect it to be. Franciscan friars, Fathers Murray Bodo and Bill Short, tell us more.
I love your rolling fields, your flowers and silver streams.
Francis had a dream, but he wasn't a dreamer. He was a romantic, but he was also very, very concrete.
He was very concrete and very literal. He would hear the words of the gospel and he would go and live them.
How do you make a dream come true? Francis had a dream, but being very practical, he wanted to make it a concrete reality. Father Murray Bodo, a Capuchin friar, wrote the book The Journey and the Dream, a poetic account of the life of St. Francis that has helped many thousands of people across the world to know and understand the little poor man from Assisi.
When he heard the gospel read on the feast of St. Matthias in 1208, February the 24th, he asked the priest what this meant, that you're not to take anything for your journey, neither a staff or a knapsack, or not even to wear sandals. And when the priest explained it to him, we don't know what the priest said to him, but he said, "This is what I want. This is what I want with all of my heart."
For Francis, his dream come true would be to become fully united with Jesus, even though this identification included the cross. He saw this as the truest, most perfect joy that could exist in life. That joy, real joy, perfect joy, was something that Francis took very seriously.
There's a story within Franciscan lore of Francis and Brother Leo going from Perugia to their place down with the lepers at St. Mary of the Angels. And Francis asks Brother Leo what perfect joy is. It's a long story that I don't want to reiterate here. But whatever Leo said, you know, this is perfect joy, to find God, to whatever he would say, no, that's not perfect joy. And so finally Brother Leo says, "Well, Father Francis, what is perfect joy?" Francis says, "Well, when we get to the Porciuncula, this little portion, which was St. Mary of the Angels, and we knock on the door, and the brother porter comes and says, 'Who are you?' And we say, 'We're Brother Leo and Brother Francis.' And he says, 'I don't know you, you're just imposters.' And he slams the door in our face. And then we knock again, and he opens the door and comes out again and said, 'Are you two here again?' He says, 'Yes, we are Francis. I am Francis, and this is Leo.' And he says, 'I don't believe you.' And he starts beating them with a club and driving them away. And Francis says to Leo, 'Now, Brother Leo, if we endure all of that for the sake of our Lord Jesus Christ with joy and good humor, that is perfect joy.'"
Which is completely the opposite of what the world would see as
exactly,
joyful.
Exactly. Exactly. It's this willingness to suffer in joy because of the sufferings of Jesus Christ, because that's what Jesus did. He came among his own and he was rejected. He comes and works miracles and some people reject him. Finally, he is totally rejected and he's finally killed. He's murdered. He's crucified. And that kind of rejection is for Francis the beginning of true inner joy. As St. John of the Cross says, the resurrection is interior to the cross. At that moment of our greatest weakness, or when we feel we're broken, we have no more to offer, and we surrender and give our heart to God, at that moment we begin to rise and true joy comes into our lives. And that's the Franciscan take on that kind of what some people would see as a form of asceticism or gritting their teeth and doing penance. Within Franciscanism, it is true joy to accept being rejected for the sake of Jesus Christ.
Which is certainly not the same as wallowing in suffering.
Oh, absolutely not. No, wallowing in suffering is masochistic. You know, some people, in fact, find religion a very delicious way to hate themselves even more than they do. That's not what it is about. It's not about hating ourselves, or it's about loving Jesus Christ. And remember, Francis wanted to be a knight, and knights would do extraordinary things to impress the lady of the castle. And Francis will do extraordinary things to impress the bride of Christ, who is Lady Poverty for him. This abstraction, this gospel poverty, he makes into this beautiful woman, this Lady
Poverty.
Who
he really loved.
Yes, he did. He did. Dante caught that in the 11th canto of his Paradiso. He said that the Lady Poverty, the bride of Christ, was widowed when Christ died on the cross. She was the only one who ascended the cross with him, and everyone thought she was ugly, and no one would marry her after Christ died. And along 1,200 years later, along comes Francis and sees how beautiful she is and takes her as his bride because she's the bride of Christ who has been widowed and no one cares about her anymore.
Francis had an amazing ability to pick up what was ugly and make it beautiful.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. That is probably one of his great secrets, that this finding sweetness and joy in what other people find repulsive and ugly. I really believe that he literally saw Christ in broken people, people who had been rejected, people who had been excluded, especially the lepers, who were that biggest symbol of that in the Middle Ages.
And he just saw them as beautiful.
Yes, he did. Not initially, but once he went among them, he said, the Lord sent me among them, and I worked mercy with them. Then it is turned into sweetness, because then he embraces that which is ugly and finds that Christ is dwelling there.
You'll always be home to me. You're part of my destiny, and I'm part of you.
And so we come to the end of our program for today. You can hear it all again in whole or in its parts if you go to our website at vaticanradio.org and click on English. I am Sister Janet Ferns. Until we meet again, may God bless you.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.